What is cultural responsiveness in teaching? How do we achieve it? Does it even matter? And does it even actually work for the learners themselves? Are we just blowing things up out of proportion because things have been working fine for the longest time, right? Maybe, maybe not. That's exactly what we're going to be diving into in this two-part series with A Step Forward. What we're doing is we're taking the presentation from the International Orientation and Mobility Online Symposium, and we are turning it into podcast and YouTube format to make it easier to digest for you. So stay tuned. Welcome to A Step Forward, a podcast for ambitious VI specialists who are challenging the status quo. I'm Cassie Maloney, your new work bestie. With over 15 years of experience as an O&M specialist, author, professional development junkie, mom, and owner of Allied Independence, I have been through the ringer. And now I'm here to bring you a boost of inspiration, information, and our favorite, innovation, as we trade feeling overwhelmed for overjoyed while we create a significant impact in the lives of our learners and still lead more balanced, fulfilling lives. So grab your favorite beverage because we're about to take a step forward. Welcome back to the podcast, my friend. This is a really exciting episode because we are going to be diving into cultural responsive orientation and mobility. This is a phrase that's being tossed around a lot, and we want to figure out, what does it actually mean? How can we do it? And does it actually work? What are the experiences of the people who have been taught in a culturally responsive manner? So what we did as the panel for the O&M Symposium is we wanted to get to the heart of this matter and not just learn from, we love all of our teachers, but not just learn from an Anglo-white lady with a master's degree, but really ask our clients and have the clients' experiences shine. Molly Pasley was the one to spearhead this presentation, and she does such a phenomenal job. And we have three separate orientation and mobility specialists, as well as three separate clients. The podcast is going to be split up from the introductions and then two of the questions. And then we'll wrap and then have the last few questions for part two. Each of the orientation and mobility specialists and the clients were asked the same exact question, and we all came up with them together to give you a well-rounded idea as to what it looks like for them. And so hopefully you can take this information and use it to take a step forward in your own teaching as you become more culturally responsive to your clients' needs. Without further ado, let's get to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's not just me. I know that's what it says on the thing, is Molly Pasley and panelists. Well, really, the focus is not on me. It's on our panelists. I'm going to provide a little bit of background to start about culturally responsive teaching. And then we're really going to get to hear from the people who are out in the field, specifically our clients who are from various parts of all over the world. So today, you're going to learn about the main principles of culturally responsive teaching practices in orientation and mobility, the experiences of O&M clients, and which culturally responsive teaching practices their O&M used that resonated with them the most, and some teaching strategies that were used by these very specific O&Ms that are when working with learners from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds all around the world. So something very important that I want to note at the start of this presentation is that you're not going to walk away from this as being a culturally responsive teacher. That's lifelong work. It's an ongoing process. This panel presentation is just a quick overview of some of the main components of culturally responsive teaching practices, which is a mouthful. So you might hear me call it CRTP over the course of this presentation, and how they are included in O&M instruction by a few O&M specialists and the experiences of a few clients in different parts of the world. The way I think of culturally responsive teaching is that this is, or being a culturally responsive teacher is called elephant work, or it's elephant work, in that it takes you a while to take one bite out of the elephant at a time. Okay, so two of our panelists are from Juneau. One is in Anchorage, Alaska, Peoria, Illinois, right in the heart of the U.S. That's where I'm from. We've got one in Guatemala, and then also one in Miami, Florida, because our panelist was originally from Guatemala, is now living in Miami, Florida. And then we have two participants or panelists from Australia. The first one is from Brisbane in Queensland, and Armadale from New South Wales, or in New South Wales in Australia. So just to kind of let you know how the flow of this is going to be, first we're going to talk about culturally responsive teaching, what it is and why we care about it. We'll introduce our panelists. We'll have a very fruitful discussion with our panelists. Okay, so the very first thing I want to do is a chat waterfall. So we've got this beautiful image of a rumbling waterfall. So we're going to do a very quick activity in the chat. First, we just want to get all of your ideas out on or in the chat. So go ahead and type in, what do you think of when you hear the words culturally responsive teaching? And Leandra, I know this is a little bit of a punt, but I'd like for you to read just kind of as they're coming in, if you could start reading maybe a handful of them.
Sure. Listening.
Okay.
Respect, awareness. Accepting, understanding, respecting, empathy. Oh, they're going so fast.
I know. Yeah. Just whichever ones you can catch. That's totally fine.
Flexibility, sensitivity, language, being respectful, just knowing the student's background and culture, being open to learning, being aware of beliefs.
A lot of really great comments in there. Thank you so much for sharing those.
You're welcome.
Okay, so some of these you'll notice that were included in the chat. So we're going to talk about some of the major components of culturally responsive teaching as presented by Geneva Gay. So something to keep in mind, many of the things that you're going to learn about, they might actually be a review, and it sounds like for some of you it is, and they might be some new ideas. Just like with culturally responsive teaching, we want to meet learners where they are, which is also why I asked you all to share what are your thoughts about, or what do you think of when you think of culturally responsive teaching? So first, we're going to start by going through some of these main components and which when you think about, they're just really good teaching. So for example, something to keep in mind is that culturally responsive teaching is an intentional teaching approach. It's not something that we come by mistake. They're also well-developed, or it's also where the teacher has developed a cultural diversity knowledge base. It's something they've spent time with. If there's students from different cultures, they have taken the time to learn about those individual cultures. The use of culturally responsive teaching, it really focuses on the learner's assets instead of why they can't do something. In O&M, we need to be aware of learners' needs and areas for growth, but where CRT differs is that we're focusing on the assets that learners bring to the table to create more meaningful learning opportunities and to enhance their growth. And teachers who want to be culturally responsive take the time to develop their own knowledge about the cultural diversity of the people with whom they work. This includes getting to know clients, families, community members, and they also implement culturally relevant curricula. And that means that in addition to learning about the culture of their clients, they have open conversations with the people involved to come up with a plan for instruction. And you'll get to hear from some of our panelists when they talk about ways that they have developed culturally relevant curricula. This next one is probably going to sound like a no-brainer, because oftentimes we're the ones who have high expectations for our students or our clients with visual impairments, and the other people in their world may not. We want to display these high expectations for all of our students. So when we think about it in terms of a tide, the tide rises to meet the expectations. So if we keep them high and provide opportunities to build learner skills through instruction, they can meet those high expectations. So we don't want to lower them, because then there really isn't anywhere for our students to go in terms of growth. The last two components of culturally responsive teaching practices are appreciating different communication styles and using multicultural examples in instruction. So in my own experience, learning about the student and their support network can really help with opening the doors to better communication and incorporating the student's culture into instruction. Okay, so what does that look like in orientation and mobility instruction? So before we can do any of the things that are listed on this slide, we want to make sure, or we need to first listen and learn. So in orientation and mobility, we want to use community norms and values to determine relevant target skills for assessment and instruction. And this is noted in Mary Tellefson's new book that came out in 2023, Culturally Responsive Orientation and Mobility Standards. We also want to create a supportive learning environment and maintain those high expectations. So if we think about it, learners exist not just solely by themselves. They live and exist in a community, and we need to learn about that community and understand their community participation to make sure that what we're teaching is relevant to that learner. If it isn't relevant, then they're not going to use the skills, as many of us know. It's just kind of like, how many times have you asked, when am I ever going to use this? I don't need to know geometry. When am I ever going to need this in my future life? We need to make sure that we're connecting the dots for our learners. And a way that we can do that is by showing that we support and are learning about their community norms in order to make their instruction relevant. So we can do this by observing what people in the same or comparable environments are able to do. When we talk about values, these can differ from person to person. So recognizing that what I value as a white woman from Illinois could be very and is likely different from maybe some of the clients that I work with. We also need to be mindful that we're not imposing our own values onto the learner, especially if they conflict with the learner's values. For example, and this is noted in Mary Tellefson's book, that independence is not a value that all people have. Instead, interdependence or codependence are more highly valued. And instead of striving for quote unquote independence, we may try to help the learner increase community involvement and participation instead of just focusing on independent travel skills. So again, you'll hear some of the panelists talk about what independent means to them within their specific context. So when we look at creating a supportive learning environment, this is building an authentic relationship with care and respect and a welcoming environment with materials that reflect the learner's diversity. And then with maintaining high expectations, some of the ways that you can do that is by just asking yourself, where can I raise the expectations for the learners? I know that we work with a wide variety, not just culturally diverse, linguistically diverse, but also they might have additional disabilities. And so how can we keep expectations high in order to help those students learn and grow to reach their highest potential? So this could be an opportunity or a way to do that would be identifying the skills needed and providing support to help the learners reach those higher expectations. So we think about scaffolding or building up the supports to help get our student to help, again, raise that tide, raise them up to the level of our high expectations. We also want to promote a growth mindset and tell them, hey, it's okay to make mistakes. I mean, we don't really want to make mistakes as we're getting ready to cross the street, but you know, let's make mistakes in more structured environments. This is a visual representation of culturally responsive, sustaining education. One is that you're centering and valuing students' cultures and identities. I know some people mentioned that in the chat about students' cultures, using rigorous and relevant curriculum, building strong positive relationships between students, families, and school staff, and supporting students to develop the knowledge, skills, and vision to transform the world. I want to give another disclaimer. So in addition to, you know, you're not going to necessarily be able to walk away from this presentation as a, you know, I am a culturally responsive teacher. You know, you're going to learn some things, but really that journey is for you to take and you making that decision. We just kind of hope to whet your appetite and give you some unique perspectives about being a culturally responsive teacher and then some examples of how that's in use. So the disclaimer I have here is that the experiences you're going to hear about today are only from the individual's point of view. They are not representative of the entire community. So we want you to keep in mind that when you walk away from this presentation that you've learned about, for example, if Uncle Steve is able to make it with us today, you've learned about Uncle Steve's experience as a vision impaired Indigenous Australian, or in the instance of Oseas, you're learning about one person from Guatemala who has relocated to the United States, but not all vision impaired people who share those cultural identities. So now we are on to our introduction. So I'll start by introducing myself, give you a little bit of background on me. I know we're doing this a little bit later in the presentation than we usually do. I'm also going to introduce our people joining us via video, and then we'll give the opportunity for Jeremy, Oseas, and Steve to introduce themselves. So my name is Molly Pasley. I'm an assistant professor in the Visual Disabilities Program at Northern Illinois University. And before starting at NIU, I worked as a teacher of students with visual impairments and a certified orientation and mobility specialist with children in all over Illinois. I've also worked with adults in the Veterans Administration system here in the U.S., and I teach graduate and undergraduate courses in our visual disabilities program. We also have Angel Black joining us from the special education. I don't remember what CESA stands for, but CESA's Vision and O&M. Or she is their vision and O&M specialist since 2016. She's also working as a project coordinator for the Alaska Deafblind Project. She's originally from Norman, Oklahoma, and she moved to Alaska in 2016, sight unseen, and now she calls it home. She received her BS in cross-categorical special education from Missouri State, and she's a nationally certified orientation and mobility specialist from Portland State. We also have Autumn Booths, who is a certified teacher of students with visual impairments and a certified orientation and mobility specialist. And she is a graduate of Kutztown University with her bachelor's degrees in special ed and visual impairment, and also in elementary education. She graduated from the University of Pittsburgh in 2020 with her master's in education, and in 2021 with her O&M certificate. She's been teaching for 6 years and currently holds the position of TSVI and comms for the Juneau School District in Juneau, Alaska. She's taught in Western and South Central Pennsylvania as well, and she's presented at various conferences throughout her teaching career. And then you'll also see a little one. Her name is Mackenzie. She's 9 years old. She's a third grade student in the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program in Juneau, Alaska. And she refers to herself as a clan leader of the Eagle Bear Clan. Okay. Jeremy, if you'd like to start introducing yourself.
Sure. Thank you very much, Molly. My name's Jeremy Hill. I, like you said, I'm certainly not an expert at working with Indigenous people in Australia, but I've worked in orientation and mobility now for about 35 years and worked around different parts of Australia. And now I presently, last couple of years, I've worked in the very top of Australia in Darwin and had the fortune to actually meet with a couple of Indigenous people and the communities around them. So I've learned a little bit, but as you say, you can't generalize about them, but I think you just have to do your homework and you have to learn about people before you dive in there. So looking forward to this discussion today.
Oseas, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Sure, from Guatemala. I currently live in Miami and I am totally blind. Very happy to be here.
Great, thank you. So the first question we're going to ask is, what is independence to you? So Oseas, if you would like to start, if you would like to start with that.
Sure. To me, independence is the ability to navigate safely and confidently from point A to point B.
Hey, Jeremy.
I think when you ask clients what is independence to them, a fascinating conversation I had with an Indigenous guy in Darwin, and he said independence can be a little bit lonely sometimes because he's used to getting around with his friends and his colleagues and his family. And so he's saying his favorite thing is interdependence. There's times when you don't, it's a hot day in Darwin and it's humid and you don't want to be hanging onto someone's arm. You actually want to follow them with some good cane skills and keep track of things and enjoy the fact of walking and that sort of thing. So it's having enough skills to be able to do the things you want to do. But then when you want to be independent, you have the skills and the confidence to do so. So I think it's a lot of different things for different people. And I know a lot of people would like to walk with other people, but to be independent when you need to be is terrific. So yeah, I learned a lot from that discussion.
Our 9-year-old Mackenzie from the Tlingit clan, and she's up in Juneau, Alaska.
If I say Mackenzie is independent, what does that mean? Does that mean
alone?
Alone and you're doing things by yourself. And is being independent important to you?
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, I can practice doing it by myself sometimes.
Okay. So we noted at the start that, you know, independence looks differently to everybody. So in Jeremy's case, what he was describing was this, you know, there's this preference toward interdependence. And then in the Tellefson book, it's not that we're necessarily striving for independence in the way that we might think of as orientation and mobility specialists as being independent. It might be that interdependence or being able to walk around the community or engage in collaborative activities with other people in your community. So our next question we have is, how have you adjusted your communication strategies to foster positive relationships with your O&M specialist? Let's start with Jeremy this time. What are some ways that you have adjusted your communication strategies to foster positive relationships? I know you are the O&M specialist, but with your clients.
Certainly, I think before you go into, and we need to know this for a lot of different families and communities, you need to do your homework before you go in. There's a, with the Indigenous people in Australia, as with probably are around the world, there's a very close network of people around that person, people who rely on assisting that person, given the fact they have a vision impairment. And so in Australia, you have a hierarchy of elders, and I'm hoping that Steve joins us soon because he's Uncle Steve, and he's very high up in the community there because he's somebody who everybody looks up to and everybody respects. And I think the fact that he has a vision impairment, he's been pivotal in assisting other people to come to terms with that, because he's been there and done a lot of the training. So making sure, because I go to a lot of remote places in Australia, making sure before you land there and go and see people, you do know who the key people are. They are important because they're the ones who spread the word and support people. And when I'm gone, because a lot of these remote visits, you go in perhaps once every few months, if you're lucky, you've got to have a support system there when you've gone. And that support system is important on the family and that sort of thing. Whereas I think you find in sort of in white Australia, you meet the client out the front door and you take them out and you give them their orientation mobility lesson, and they go back and they might tell mum and dad about it if they want to. But in societies I visit, everybody knows what's going on. You've got a lovely photograph there where Steve lives. It's a very green place, Armidale, and it's a very cold place. It's quite high up. And that's the driving into the university grounds called the University of New England. It's a very American name, isn't it? So it's a very, that's Elm Street, actually. And it goes a beautiful orange colour in the autumn time, and all the leaves fall on the ground. So there are some amazing places to teach O&M around Armidale. And I think where I work in the more remote and the more areas of Queensland, I'm learning that because I don't live there. You ask the person themselves, where would you like to have your lesson? Where is a nice, cool place under the trees? And so they are the experts of their own environment. So as I was saying, just knowing who the agencies are too, because some terrific agencies that have set up around these people, and they're very good at helping to support my skills when I'm not around too. And then, as I say, knowing where to practice, where would they like to go that they feel at ease? A lot of people, you and I, teaching people, probably don't want to be seen walking up and down your main street, because that's where people know you. So we go and find a slightly quieter area or somewhere where people don't know you or recognize you. And Indigenous people are very supportive for each other. So if you go somewhere that's too busy, they're all shouting, hey, you're doing a great job. And hey, what are you doing? And it's all very lovely and very interactive, but you don't get a lot done because an awful lot of conversations going on too. So I'm learning a lot about it. And I think the biggest thing I've learned is to stop and listen and pay attention to what's going on around them in their community.
Thanks for sharing that, Jeremy. Hey, Oseas, how have you adjusted your communication strategies to foster positive relationships with your O&M specialist?
Well, I learned to be direct when I talk to my orientation mobility instructor. I like to let my instructor know which ones are my strengths and which ones are my weaknesses. And for example, I don't feel like I'm good with maps. So sometimes tactile maps, rather than helping me, they confuse me. So I prefer probably that we walk the route and we just focus on landmarks first. I would do Saturday guide first a couple of times to walk through the route and focus on the two or three landmarks, and then I can try the route. If we were to use a tactile option, it has to be a bigger tactile, let's say a map, not those small ones. But also, since I read Braille, Braille means a lot. Like if I'm going to a big campus, I tell the instructor, this is what I want from the lesson. And please let's not focus on my cane skills, because I've been using the cane since I was 6. So that's more than 30 years ago. So let's not focus on the basic. Let's focus on this, this, and this. So being straightforward has helped me strengthen my communication with my O&M instructor.
So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, Oseas. You're in a unique situation that you have received orientation and mobility instruction in Guatemala and also in the United States. What changes, or how did you, if you did, have to adjust your communication with your O&M specialist? How did that differ when you were living in Guatemala versus when you were living in the U.S.?
Yes, well, first of all, I had to learn the language here in the U.S. My primary training was in Spanish, so I had to learn to touch technique. For example, the type of tip that I use for my cane, the parts of the cane in English. So, for example, if I'm going to cross the street and they tell me flag, it took me a while to realize what flag meant before crossing the street. And then the terminology, even when I had already learned English, learning the terminology was key to start understanding my lessons better. Also, I learned that we were incorporating technology into my lessons, and that was something that I wasn't used to. So I was paying attention to some other things that I had not paid attention before. And also if I were to request for help that is in Spanish and in the community that lives here in Miami, if I'm going to cross the street, they would say in a different way that we say it in Guatemala. So definitely learning the language, not just English, but also the way they speak Spanish in Miami was very helpful to make my O&M lessons more meaningful to my day-to-day skills or routine.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Stay tuned for part two, where we finally get to reveal if Uncle Steve actually got his technology to work. And we will wrap up with a few last questions. We're going to be learning how our clients and orientation and mobility specialists include family or their support networks in their O&M, if there are any barriers to accessing O&M in their community, and the cultural modifications that the orientation and mobility specialists use in order to provide a more responsive educational experience for their learners. That'll be happening next week. But until then, I hope that you can use this information to take a step forward.